Well, again, it's good to be here with you this morning and to open the scriptures together. This past week, I was away on a clergy retreat, and it was a very ascetic retreat, meaning that I slept on a hard floor and ate gruel and dry bread. And so it's good to be back with you today. Now, it was a very beautiful place, and we were spoiled and fed well, and so it was a wonderful time. But I'm just really glad to be home and to be here with you. It's an amazing thing to be in one of the most beautiful spots in the world. Where the retreat was is in the top five places in the world to go yachting. So that's something. And so here I'm in this very beautiful spot. And just found myself yearning to be home with my family and with my church. And so I'm very happy to be here with you this morning today. We're going to continue looking at the impact and the benefits and the essentials of the resurrection of Jesus. Last week, what we looked at is the bodily resurrection, not just of Christ, but of us. So that we are promised to share in his bodily resurrection. And because of that, that we can say confidently that our bodies are for the Lord, and the Lord is for our bodies. Isn't that a great verse of Paul's that we get to put our trust in? So when we're going through physical ailments and struggles and trials, it's important for us to remember that the gospel is not only for the spiritual life. The gospel is for our physical bodies. And in the weeks to come, we're going to look at how the gospel is for the resurrection of all things, not just for us and for our bodies. But today, I want to look at a topic of great value and I think of great hope. And it's the topic of holiness. That in the resurrection, we are called to holiness. That the Lord commands us to be holy. But that he also completes holiness for us. And so those will be the three aspects of holiness that I want to look at today. That he calls us to holiness. That he commands holiness. And that he completes holiness in the life of the Christian. And so I'm going to look at three main texts to do that. But I think the big questions behind this are, does Jesus change our functional life? Does the good news of the gospel have the power to create within us the things that we have been unable to create in ourselves? So for me, when I think about this topic, I bring to this topic all sorts of questions about my life where I go, I am unable to do what I know is good and right in this area of my life. Do you have areas like that? Do you have areas that you find I keep falling into failure here? I keep choosing the very thing I know I don't want to do? Or is it just me? Just me? I'm probably worse than all of you. I can just about guarantee that. But that's what I bring to this topic. I bring a very real life, desperate question to go, does the gospel help me in these areas? Because this is where I need help. The gospel so far has shown me that there are reasons why I fall into these besetting sins so often. And those reasons have to do with my own sinfulness, but they have to do with my story. Right? That my story has created in me a need for comfort. My story and my life has made me fall easily into feelings of loneliness. And those deep broken places in my heart have led me to addictive patterns and cycles in my life of finding the wrong ways of trying to fulfill those broken parts of my heart. So if he enters into my story to save me from those roots, and he offers me forgiveness and redemption and cleansing for all of the wrong, broken, sinful actions that I have done because of those needs inside of me, now the question is, does he help me to do what is good and what is right from a mended, healed, whole heart? Are you with me? Do you think these are helpful questions? Is this not what our society and our culture is desperate to know? Is change possible? That's the core question here. Is a life of goodness so good that it would be called holy possible? And I think fundamental to that question, is it a gift? Or is it something that I have to achieve by my own strength and merit? Is it something I can receive from Jesus as a gift? And if so, that's a pretty good gift, isn't it? So, who's ready for some good news? So, as we look at these, you know, questions, and as we consider these things, I want to start with the 1 Peter text that we looked at, that Karen read for us this morning. So listen to what's promised here. Therefore, this is verse 13 of chapter 1. Therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. So what's Peter saying here? Don't be formed by your old life that didn't know about the good news and grace of Jesus. So don't live a life patterned after your own self-sufficiency. Now live a life conform to all the good news of the grace that is offered in Jesus. But as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. So the first part of holiness is that we are called to it by Jesus. So the same Jesus that came and was incarnate and was crucified and is resurrected is now calling us into a life that's defined by grace. So much grace that is available that we could live a life that is one of holiness. So what do we mean by holiness? What is this language? Typically, throughout the scriptures, especially in the Old Testament, when we hear the language of holiness, it's the pure goodness and perfection of God. When he makes something else holy, he's essentially saying, this thing is set apart for my goodness. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? But it's a very high bar. We're talking about perfect perfection. We're talking about so good that there is nothing bad in it. That's God's character. So good that there is no even inkling of sin. This is holiness. And so we're called to be holy as he is holy. Verse 17, and if you call on him as Father, who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile. So this is this idea that he's actually calling us to participate in this level of goodness. He wants us to live a life this way. And it's not just a suggestion. He commands it. So in Matthew chapter 5, I hope soon in our future together we will teach through the book of Matthew. But in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says this in verse 17 of chapter 5, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Now imagine you're just a normal, everyday, blue-collar, white-collar person hearing this message. You're in a system created by the scribes and the Pharisees, of which they've defined holiness and all of their rules and all of their expectations. And then comes God, the Messiah in flesh, and says, "You won't enter the kingdom of heaven unless you're more righteous than these guys." Does that sound like good news? At first you're going, "Whoa, I'm already failing to live up to their standards. How could I possibly be more righteous?" But the point that Jesus is making here, and what we see in the following verses, which we don't have time to unpack today, is that God's definition of righteousness is much deeper than man's definition of righteousness. For the Pharisees and the scribes, righteousness looked like keeping all of these really strict rules and being confident in your own ability to keep those things. Our culture today is still doing that. Self-help books, CrossFit, diet plans, financial planning, all of it is the same thing. Systems of going, keep the rules and you'll be okay. Keep the rules and you'll be good. Keep the rules and you can be confident, right? That's our world. Hinduism, keep the rules, you'll be okay. Buddhism, keep the rules, you'll be okay. All of them, every system, secular and non, it's all systems of you keeping rules. Now Jesus gives something very different, very contrasting to that. Jesus is saying, and what we see in the following verses here, is it's about the heart and it's about trust. And so the righteousness that Jesus commands of us is deeply authentic and genuine. He wants to provide us with a change of heart and a change of mind and a change of our actions. The systems just want you to change your actions. So the commandment that Jesus gives here, though, is not that he's going to relax the rules or change them. Instead, he's saying he's going to fulfill the rules. He's going to fulfill everything that is necessary, and then he's going to give that to us. He's going to accomplish it for us and then give it to us. That sounds like a good plan, doesn't it? But he's commanding not just the Ten Commandments. He's commanding something more and deeper. Think about the Ten Commandments for a moment. What's a common one we know? Have you ever driven through Montana? If you don't know the Ten Commandments, just drive through Montana. It's on every billboard. It's an interesting evangelistic tactic, I think. Okay, so every billboard in Montana's got the Ten Commandments up there. But think of them. Thou shalt not steal, for example. Why would you steal? because you don't have, or because you think you don't have. But let's go a little bit deeper. Why do we really steal deep down? Because we believe that God isn't going to provide for us. Why would you cheat on your taxes? Because you think you've got to hold on to every little bit of money you got. You've got to hoard it. Because you're scared you're going to run out. Right? Why would we murder? Because we're angry. Because we think there's going to be no justice. Because we think we have to take matters into our own hands. Now, when we look at the Ten Commandments, we tend to go, well, I don't steal, and I don't murder, right? And I don't steal other people's wives. And we tend to think, we're covered, don't we? But Jesus pushes it further and says, not only should you not murder, you shouldn't be angry with your brother. So Jesus is going much further than the Pharisees, isn't he? Why would Jesus push us so much further? He's saying, I don't just want you to not murder or not steal. I want you to not have a heart that's full of anger. I want you to have a heart that's not full of desperate fear that causes you to steal. So he raises the bar, doesn't he? But for every inch that Jesus raises the bar, he raises the promise of what he's going to fulfill and give you. So our goal is not just to stop murdering people. You know who you are out there. And the goal is not to just hold back from murder. A truly saved, transformed life looks like a heart that's not steeped in anger, needing retribution, needing judgment, needing to take matters into our own hands. Do you feel that part? And the gospel of Jesus is saying that God can do that transforming work at that deep level. So don't lust. Right? So we know we shouldn't steal somebody else's spouse or covet our neighbor's spouse. But what do we do with feelings of lust and desire in the heart? Do we just hold off from doing the action and that's holy while hiding and cherishing thoughts we don't know how to change? Does that feel like righteousness? For some of us, our hearts feel like a rabid dog on a chain that we hope doesn't break. That's how my heart felt before the gospel. Does that feel like salvation? No. Always on the edge of committing another sin? No, that doesn't feel like salvation. The salvation that's promised here that says, let's heal the wounds that drive the lust. Let's change the heart to find fulfillment in God so you don't need envy anymore. You don't need fantasy anymore. We have fulfillment. This is what Jesus is commanding his people would have. He calls us to it and then commands us to do it because he's providing everything necessary to accomplish it. So let's go to James chapter 2 now. Who likes the book of James? I'm a big fan of the book of James. Now, some people think it's problematic. Some people think James and Paul disagree with each other are at war with each other and have different understandings of the gospel. I think that is very untrue. Rather, I look at James and I look at Paul and I see them as so beautifully complementary in how they round out our understanding of the gospel. They go so well together. It's like, salt and caramel. You ever had salted caramel? That's contrasting, but very good, isn't it? It's probably the thing my wife would agree with most about my preaching. It's like, yes, amen to salted caramel. So James chapter 2, James is rounding out people's understanding of the gospel. Because the gospel is a difficult thing that always pushes you to go, your main job is to receive. And in doing so, we have to rest from much of our works, don't we? The works that we tend to do to try and save ourselves. And so Paul does a good job of pushing us to say, stop trying to save yourself and receive it from Jesus as a gift of grace, right? James then rounds it out for us to help us understand what that looks like. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? What a great question. Can that faith save him? And then he does this explanation here, which perfectly helps us understand the nature of faith and the nature of the gospel. If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for what? For the body. What good is that? What a great phrase. What good is that? So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. So here's the point that James is making for us to round out the gospel. Having received Jesus for our heart, his story becomes my story. His death becomes my salvation and my forgiveness from all my sin and all my guilt and all my shame and all my self-hatred. Now, that same faith in the resurrection says, I have the will, the heart, the mind, the strength, and the ability to do what is good because of Jesus. That faith keeps going in the resurrection. Faith doesn't end at the cross. Receiving from Jesus doesn't end at the cross. We have to receive from Jesus in the resurrection. And that's believing that we have the ability and the calling and the purpose to do good works from Jesus. Are you with me? Are you asleep? That's the good news here. And that if the gospel only offered you forgiveness and only offered you freedom from your shame and your guilt, but didn't also offer you the ability to do what is good, to do what is right, to do what is healthy, and to do what is powerful, to do what matters. If the gospel didn't do that, it would be the same thing as going to a poor person and saying, peace be with you on the inside. Would you be at peace in your heart, but offer nothing to their circumstances? Offer nothing to them in terms of warmth, and offer nothing to them in terms of food. The resurrection of Jesus is those things. To be cloaked in a new ability, new strength, new power, new purpose, to do what is good and right and holy. And food to eat, strength, energy, will, desire, motivation. That's the resurrection. That you would have the things inside that you never had before. Before, we had a rot in the gut that made us eat terrible things and give ourselves away and exploit ourselves to try and get a morsel of food. The gospel fills us with grace, fills us with good food so that we can do good work for His sake. So the gospel not only calls us to holiness, not only commands holiness, but completes holiness. Jesus does this work in us for His glory. Do you believe me? What it takes in me is to so believe that I am in Jesus and that what is true of Jesus is true of me, that I will act accordingly. And that it gives me a new will, a new desire, new convictions, new motivation. And guess what? I never had any of those things without Jesus. Some of you out there have strong wills, strong convictions. Before Jesus, I didn't have that. I was just a gaping need that would try and fill that with anything. I'm guessing you probably haven't heard your pastor say that kind of thing. But that's the truth. I was a gaping wound trying to be filled. I think that's more true of most of us, isn't it? So it's time for us to talk turkey and be honest about that stuff in the church. Without Jesus, I don't have a will to do good. I'll cut every corner I can. I will. Without Jesus, I don't have the deep convictions to do what is right. I don't have that. But with Jesus, I have that and more. He gives me that as a gift. So, but there's only one hook with a gift. It has to be received. Right? A gift can't be enjoyed unless it's received. And so for us as Christians, that is the work that we put ourselves to, is I've got to do a lot of receiving of this gift so that I can enjoy and do it. That this is the life I want to live. Now, I want to read a few more verses in closing as comfortable words. I'll probably read them again as we celebrate communion. Philippians 2, verse 13, for it is God who works in you both to will and to work for His good pleasure. So hear it again. It is God who works in you both to will, the desire, the motivation, and to work, the strength, the wisdom, the skill to do it, for His good pleasure. This is one of the things that I try to help people understand. The gospel is pleasurable. It feels good. It's fun. Like doing good, right things, not as a yoke, but as a, I get to do this, and I can do this, and I couldn't do it before. That's quite enjoyable. And then you see the good thing that you did have good results and bear good fruit. That's fun. I think I say it just about every time after we pray before service. Let's have fun today, don't I? The gospel is fun because it works. It changes us in the ways we need most. God is pleased. It's for His good pleasure, and we get to participate in that. Do you want to hear another one? Ephesians 2, verse 10. For we are His workmanship. We are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works. Is that good? Which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. So your good works, listen to this verse, your good works, you are His workmanship in Christ Jesus. So Jesus is the tool that He has used to work on you and to craft you into something good and beautiful and holy and pleasurable to Him. And He has planned for you good works that bear good fruit and have good impact in this world. Does that sound good yet? And He planned these good works for you way before He ever saved you, so that you get to just walk in His goodness that's gone ahead of you. On Easter Sunday, when we hide candy, so down we live in Beachcomber on the Neuse Bay, and at the tip of Beachcomber, there's a Beachcomber Regional Park, and it's beautiful. And we went down into this beautiful place, and we hid plastic eggs full of candy all over the place. And I went ahead of my kids, and I put candy in places that they could see it and that they could find it, and they just had to follow the trail of good things. It's fun, isn't it? Some things I put up a little bit higher that they couldn't reach at first, and they had to really go after it. But was it any less a good thing? There's parts of your life that you go, oh, I haven't seen this breakthrough yet. I haven't seen this myself able to do this yet. And you're still working at receiving enough Jesus to do that, aren't you? But that's part of the fun. Because you know your relationship with Him doesn't depend on that. It comes from that. And so I hid all this candy throughout that whole park for my kids to find good thing after good thing after good thing. And it gave me joy. And I'd gone ahead of them, hadn't I? And I'd prepared good things for them, hadn't I? That's your life. You have parts of your life, parts of your marriages, parts of your finances, parts of your physical health, parts of how you eat, and parts of how to fight and conquer addictions and worry and ways of thinking. And God has gone ahead of you and prepared good things for that part of you, for you to receive and enjoy and live from. Do you believe this, church? Are we Christ's church? Then this is our story. You want one more? It's 10:57. It's a little late. I don't like to go late, but if you want one more, I can. Well, if you do, Jeannie. Titus 2:14. That Jesus gave Himself to us to redeem us, to ransom us from all lawlessness, and to purify for Himself a people for His own possession, who are zealous for good works. We are passionate in our pursuit of doing good. Not because we have to, but because we get to. Not because we fear Him, but because we know Him. This is the good news. That we would be zealous for what is good. That we would be excited about growth. That we would be hopeful about new strength and new victory. So much so that we would say to the darkest places in this island, Jesus works for this. And Jesus will work for you if you let Him. This is our story. The word of the Lord. Let's prepare ourselves for His table.